This is Danielle Robay from Bookmarked by Reese's Book Club. A new car is kind of like a new book. It takes you places you never thought you could go. What will you drive into the next chapter of your life? It's fun to dream about your next car, but when you're done dreaming, you need to head to cars.com. Cars.com has the tools and expert advice to help you find your dream car. Their advanced search filters allow you to explore 2 million new and used cars so that you can find the perfect car. Start your search with cars.com. Where to next?
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is The Big Breakdown. A long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Lots of people getting up in arms about this, so we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about the reality of what could actually happen here in the Nick Reiner case. Nick Reiner just filed a 136-page petition demanding over $1.5 million from a trust his parents set up when he was a baby. As my doorbell rings. And here's the uncomfortable part. He might actually have an argument. The petition says the payouts were mandatory at 30 and 35 in terms of years. Belle, it's okay. We're good. Mandatory at 30 and 35. No strings, no discretion. Nick turned 30 more than 2 years before his parents were killed and reportedly never saw a dime of it. So that's the interesting part going into this. This payday would have been 2 years before the murders took place of what he was supposed to get mandatorily. This is the claim that the Nick camp is making. And he wants it. He wants to use it because he wants to hire Alan Jackson back as his representative. And the way it's sitting right now, they're saying, no, you're not getting the money. Eric, let's walk through this. I mean, what sort of grounds does he stand on to get his money?
Reasonably solid grounds, I think, Tony, with respect to the disbursement to which he was entitled at 30. With respect to the 35-year-old disbursement, that's a whole different story. But for the 30-year-old one, that was before any allegation that he had harmed his parents. It preceded that event in time. And so it sounds like he was legally entitled to those funds. For some reason, they were not paid. And it's appropriate to bring a legal action to try to enforce what a trust says and to get those funds.
Yeah, I'm curious, because I did a lot of research on this morning just because I'm trying to understand trust, why people have trust. Basically, it's for people with a lot of money want to protect their money is the bottom line of it. But I'm really curious because, yeah, they wrote it in. And once the family creates a trust and they created it when he was born, it's like removed from their control. It's tax sheltered. It's entitled to the kids, and they do it. And gradually, as they get older and hopefully more mature, they can use it more more responsibly. So, at what point then? How come the trustee of this and the new trustee came on board? I guess about a year ago from this. How does he even have control when it's actually written into the contract to begin with? So, how could he even withhold it a couple years ago? Even though I know there was issues with his mental health and things like that, but how could he even held it back then?
It's not entirely clear to me what legal authority the trustee would have to withhold those funds. I mean, the trustee in this kind of an irrevocable mandatory trust scenario is really charged with effectuating the terms of that trust. So they sort of do the mechanics of it. They make sure people get paid and I'm not aware of some legal authority this trustee would have to say, for whatever reason, I don't like this guy, or I don't, or his mental health is concerning me, or whatever, or substance use, what have you. I'm just not going to give him these funds. I'm not sure the trustee has that discretion.
Because that actually raised a question with me in the sense of, all right, so, because like you said, the language in that trust, I've never seen this one, but doing the research on them in general, it's very solid, rock solid. It is what it is. Could he been become in legal jeopardy for it actually not executing it according to the timeline?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's sort of, it could be just a general negligence theory that, hey, you had a duty under this trust to disperse these funds, and you ought to have, and you didn't. And now this person is out all of this money, and perhaps Nick has suffered other claimed losses from the non-disbursement. And that trustee could be in a precarious situation.
And one more before I bounce back, Tony. So sorry. So, again, my conjecture hat is on. This is what happens when I'm away for a couple of days, right? So Alan Jackson said he's willing to be back on the case now that there's money back on the table. And he didn't say that first time, but we said it was probably because of money. So is there a possibility that Nick, now can he do this when he's, being charged with this, could file a civil lawsuit against the trustee that Alan Jackson could then also do to get money from, like, both from the trust as well as a civil lawsuit from withholding?
Hard to say. Alan Jackson might have some kind of conflict because he is set to gain from the proceeds of such action,
right,
such that he couldn't be an objective legal counsel on it. So I'm not sure if he could do that, but I can see why he might want to.
Right.
Are we staring at motive for murder here? The fact that he didn't get his money 2 years before he murdered them?
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah, that hadn't even occurred to me. I don't know how much money is in controversy here, but we're talking about Rob Reiner, a famed
producer,
director, and actor for decades. I bet it's a lot of money. And if a person was out, seven figures or more, they'd be pretty peeved. And that could compel them to take some action based on that feeling.
I'm wondering, because we've been sitting here going, why did he do this? Well, he's, mentally ill. He's got this schizoaffective disorder. It's this, it's that. He probably didn't get his money, is what it seems to look like here. 2 years before, you're supposed to get your $1.5 million. It's a lot of drugs he can buy with that for a period of time. It seems like this may be making a lot of sense now when you kind of line it up with the broken brain, the thinking, I mean, him still living at home with his parents up until the end. I could see Nick thinking, I'm going to play the game. Eventually I'll get that. And I wonder how much of a carrot on a stick this money was that was being dangled up by mom and dad. You need to stay with us. You need to get clean. Then you'll get your money. You just need to do this, and then we'll trust you with it. I mean, this is all my conjecture, but I'm thinking this may lead to some very interesting roads to go down. And if it does go down that road, not that there's ever a justification for murder, but I am wondering if this is going to be, brought up. It's not like, I don't know that they're going to be able to argue that Nick didn't do this. It's pretty clear he did. But what are the circumstances to which he did it under? Why did he do it? When, you don't have to prove motive, but if you're trying to sway a jury in one way or another, he's mentally ill, he needs help, and then his parents are withholding this money, and then he lashed out and killed them.
So it's interesting. So Eric, based on that, and that's a really interesting thing to bring up, Tony. So legally, because it looked like there was an argument inside the house, and that's what the conjecture is. Mm-hmm. There's a fight, an argument, but never really an understanding, because they're just claiming mental illness and all the garbage going on in his brain. And that's what Alan Jackson said he's going to do is claim, by means of insanity. But they're always looking for a triggering event. Could they use this then as a triggering event as saying, hey, he didn't get this? And would that help or hinder defense or the prosecution?
Yeah, it doesn't matter, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in thinking about it, it seems like it wouldn't help the defense in a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, because in that defense, you're arguing, hey, he didn't know right from wrong. You know, sometimes those folks are under delusions and hallucinations, and they don't know what they're doing. They can't control their faculties, things like that. But if you have a concerted plan, if you have a sequence of events, like this guy got pissed off because he was entitled to more than $1 million and realized his parents were withholding it wrong from him, and then he went after his parents because of that. That seems to suggest he does know right from wrong. He did know what he was doing. He did this on purpose, and it seems to undercut a potential not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah. This could be really good for prosecution. Yeah, I see someone put it in there. Yeah, 1,600 to 2,000 per hour. I saw that. And so Alan Jackson typically looks for 250,000 as a retainer fee. And so Nick Reiner is due 750,000 if he ruins the lawsuit for half the conservatorship that he should have gotten already. The rest of it, it's actually can be withheld because you can't profit from the death of, in other words, if you were the cause of death of someone, you can't get their inheritance.
Yeah.
And so that's why the other half's being held up.
I mean, and we'll get to that in a moment of what sort of levers the family can pull here. But it does make you wonder a lot about what, you know, what are the motivating factors here? And is this something, I mean, is Nick Reiner a prime example of why maybe mom and dad or whoever has the money and has reproduced a spawn and thinks, you know what, I got some money, I'm going to start a trust right now so when they're older, they can have it. There's a lot of assumption that goes on when you create a trust for someone who's a very small child. And there's not a lot of control you have at a certain point of those funds should said person not be as upstanding of an individual as you might have hoped they would become when they were three. At the end of the day, a lot of these trusts are exactly what the law says it is. It's yeah, you get your money. Good luck. And a lot of people use it to destroy their own lives. And mom and dad or whoever set it up have very little legal leverage to stop it. But it looks like they had some leverage to stop it here for those several years. I mean, and that can just be simply, we're not making the transaction. Legally, we have to, but we're not going to. You're going to take a court to force us to do it. And if you got the addict or the junkie who doesn't have the legal means on their side to fight for that, well, then it doesn't get transferred. Illegal or not. I'm wondering, is this a lesson of being more cautious of blindly putting money into a trust? I get the tax benefits of it. It makes sense. It's ways that you can save money for children and not have it taxed. It is very advantageous. It's a great mechanism, but there's a lot of assumption going on that person's going to be able to handle it at a certain age. Should this be reevaluated in general, or is it, you know, you roll the dice?
Yeah, Tony, you know, I think most of us have encountered like a trust fund baby. It just at some point in our lives. And some of them are doing great and they're prosperous and productive. And some of them are the opposite of that. Some of them are just sort of coasting through life. They have money and they are destroying their bodies, destroying their minds, not working, getting into drugs, things like that. And so I think that, it's fun to be like optimistic in the beginning and say, oh, you know, this kid's going to be great. But what they should consider is building more discretion for the trustee into these trusts. My understanding is this one for the Reiners was pretty mandatory and obligatory. There wasn't really a lot of leeway that anyone would have legally to say, hey, we don't want to give you the money. Perhaps you can build in those conditions that say, like, hey, if the person's experiencing with contending with substance use at 30, then the trustee and their discretion could withhold the payments. I think you could build those provisions in, don't often see them.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Like, can that stuff be built into a structure like that? Or, I mean, it's probably like a financial attorney type question because you're getting into tax law and stuff as well with that, as far as the restrictions of giving that money out or that person taking their money at a certain point. I know there's different repercussions for withdrawing. You know, it's like withdrawing early from a 401k or something. There are certain structures with these trusts that exist with the IRS that, so I wonder, I don't know the answer to it, or if like we can reject giving this to you, but then you're going to, whoever made the trust will then face the financial penalties from the government for tax. I don't know, but it would be nice if there were more provisions that existed to protect someone that needs protecting. But then again, you go down the rabbit hole too of people who just don't want to give their money out at some point, or they're being petty and like, I want this money for myself. You didn't do this. Or you didn't. There's a lot of reasons this could be abused as well. So if you go down the road of, well, let's tighten it up for a situation like Nick, then it also completely changed the dynamics for all the other situations out there that are probably far greater than his.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what I did, just because of all the issues surrounding this, I looked it up beforehand, and it's 40% of all probate cases in LA County involve trust disputes and litigation. 35% involve allegations of undue influence. 25% center on claims of lack of capacity, and over 75% are driven by undue influence, lack of capacity, fraud, improper trust administration. It's riddled with all these issues. And as I understood, and Eric, I don't know if you had an opportunity to take a deeper look at this. I just did a cursory of the trust that they set it up. It's totally inflexible. Is that the way these things work? Is that it, once it's established, it's inflexible? Because I guess that's how they do the check. Shelter of it is it's when it's completely out of the hands of those who had the money to begin with, they are no longer responsible or culpable financially for it.
Yeah, Robin, it seems like the trade-off that's happening in a trust like this are that if the funds are protected from tax consequences for a substantial period of time under the essentially the guarantee that at some point they are going to be dispersed, and at some point there might be additional tax and financial ramifications because of that. So I can understand why perhaps flexibility on these trusts is disfavored, because a person could put all this money in a trust, not have it taxed, and then when the payday right. comes, they could say, I don't want to do this, and I'm come up with some excuse, and the government's not going to get their money. And so I could see how flexibility might be disfavored under these sort of financial vehicles.
Yeah.
Lots of questions. How can what can the Reiner family do? What are Jake and Romy looking at in terms of what they can do to protect their money, to protect themselves, and at the end of the day, protect their brother who is not able to really make sound decisions. And that's an opinion. That's the important part. That is an opinion. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We're going to get all into that in our next segment. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss it. So Nick Reiner filed his petition. Now the ball is in the family's court. Literally, Jake and Romy already cut the money off once, and the trust itself has been a revolving door. The payout was reportedly withheld for 2 years before Paul Kanin took over in February. Kanin raised his own concerns about Nick's judgment, and now he's out. Brand new trustee, Jody Montgomery, was just appointed and is already apparently asking to meet with Nick. Eric, Kane's stated reason for not giving into the past, capacity to make sound decisions. Nick's lawyers have fired back saying no court has ever declared him incompetent. Kind of. I mean, how much weight does a trustee's judgment call like that? I mean, actually carry in a probate court? Because again, it's an opinion. It's someone saying he's not. It doesn't have the capacity to make good decisions. Well, great. That's kind of something that a judge or a doctor needs to make. And then the judge can go, yep, I agree with it. We don't really have that here. I mean, unless you go back to where he was, there was that moment several years back where it was under California estate where he was, what was it? There was some ruling that was made where he was, I think, incompetent. It was something. I don't want to say it incorrectly, but it was something where he was, do you know what I'm talking about? I'm trying to think what the terminology was, where he was under the supervision, basically.
Conservatorship.
Conservatorship. That's what I'm looking for. The conservatorship for I'm that year, essentially. And then the way California law is set up is that the conservatorship can be battled, you know, 50 ways to Tuesday, because California doesn't like having conservatorships, and which a year it was lifted. So I don't know. Do they have much of an argument here when one person's opinion is they don't have the sound capacity to make decisions? Again, that's an opinion.
You know, if I was a judge, the trustee's opinion as to the capacity of the recipient would matter, but it certainly would not be dispositive. It would not just be taken as gospel and be like, oh, well, okay, this trustee can sort of do whatever they want. And, you know, because that's so ripe for abuse, Tony. And I think, you know, trustees under so many different scenarios could, they might not like the person. They might not like the person's girlfriend. They might, you know, these things can come up and they could use, you know, this alleged lack of capacity as a pretext to not give what is a lawfully obligated distribution. And so I'm not sure the judge is going to just, you know, look at that and say, oh, this trustee had good reason not to disperse, especially without some kind of a medical report, some kind of psychological analysis. I think that opinion alone really is not going to hold a ton of weight at all in the eyes of a probate judge.
Is there any way you think that the family can argue this legally and that would actually hold up or even get the time of day? Because it looked pretty rock solid just looking at how that trust was set up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they can talk about the conservatorship. They could say, hey, look, this guy needed somebody to manage his affairs because he was incapable of doing so. But if that conservatorship was then lifted at some point, that tends to indicate that the individual no longer required someone to make all their decisions for them. And at that juncture, probably a court is going to look at it and say the distribution should have happened. And so I'm not sure how much legal foundation that this family is going to have to try to resist at least the distribution at 30 years old. Like I said, the distribution at 35 years old is a much different story.
And I remember the conservatorship, when they initially had it, it was established, and again, this is when we first started covering this case, and so correct me when my memory fails me properly on this one, everyone, but it only lasted a certain period of time just because of, basically, I'm going to just butcher
the law
this,
in California.
Yeah, the law in California, I was going to say statute of limitations of it expired, and so they couldn't continue the conservatorship. So is there any way the family could argue that the law prohibit him from keeping it in place when they really wanted it in place, that actually could be a mitigating factor?
Sure. You know, I think a judge could look at that and say, you know, or someone could argue that, hey, the reason the conservatorship ended was not because he didn't need it. It was because of some other legal mechanism. He still needed it. So they could certainly make that argument.
At the end of the day, the path to Nick getting the money and making the argument of the 30-year-old that was entitled to a certain dollar amount that didn't receive it, that's, I mean, I don't know. It might be a pretty strong argument. But with all cases, you know, it takes time. It takes time to go through the legal system and for this to be worked out, for a ruling to take place. Are the Reiner kids, Nick and Romy, is this more of a game of running the clock out than it is necessarily arguing the principles of it? Because time is of the essence here for Nick. If he wants Alan Jackson as his defense attorney, well, Alan Jackson's going to want a guarantee of pay, and he's going to want that as soon as possible. He's not going to take at least my assumption is he's not going to take well, hopefully this works out in court at some point and you get that $1.5 million. Let me invest $10 million into your defense for my own firm. It's not going to happen. And with this being a case that it's going to take some time to work its way through the system, how long does probate court take for something like this to work its way out? Could this take years for it to be settled? Essentially, can they run it all the way where he's not going to get the money for the attorney? He goes to trial, Slayer statute goes into place, and then that essentially rectifies the problem. Or would that rectify the problem? Is there an argument that can be made there of, well, yes, Slayer statute in place after the fact, but at 30 they were still alive, so he should still be getting that money. He's still entitled to that.
Yeah, you know, I do not think that the family could run out the clock. And here's why. Probate court can take months or years. It could be a very prolonged process. However, most states, and I believe California has, have a wrinkle written into the probate statutes that essentially says, is there is a time-sensitive need for legal counsel in a criminal case, including if the individual is charged with murdering the people who set up the trust as parents, that can really take precedence, and courts are going to look at that. They're not going to slow play that. They realize that the time is of the essence, like you said, and I think that under these circumstances, a probate court is going to push this to the top of the priority list because of this pending homicide case for which the alleged beneficiary is requesting the funds now.
Can it be appealed?
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
What's up?
Can it be appealed? Like, say, let's say the court says, no, we don't agree with you. We don't think you should get that money. Can you appeal that? Yeah. Can he appeal that?
I think he can. I think either side could appeal. Yeah, I think he could appeal that. I think if the court said, hey, you do have to give Nick the money, the family could appeal that and try to delay things further. However, I bet if that happened, what the court would do would they would probably say, hey, he gets at least some of the funds now pending this appeal due to the time sensitive nature of things. And then if the appeal works out in favor of the family, perhaps he has to try to give the funds back or something, at which time they're going to be extinct.
And there'll be no funds to give back. Could this be a lever from a defense standpoint? Let's say Nick goes to trial. Let's say Nick doesn't get the money. This court says no, or it's caught up in appeals, or it's just caught up in litigation. Goes to trial, found guilty, doesn't have Alan Jackson. It's a state representative attorney, and it's just end of day. That's what happens. Could this be an appellate issue for Nick to argue? Not that he didn't have competent legal representation, but he was not afforded the ability to have the representation that he would technically have been entitled to had that money been given to him. Should a court down the road on appeal or whenever they settle this decide, yeah, you can have that money. You're already found guilty, but here's the money. Enjoy a lot of Snickers and commissary and $1.5 million. I don't know. I mean, is that a road that could be traveled by Nick? And should he hold that in his back pocket if that's a possibility?
It would be a creative avenue. And certainly if someone is convicted of murder on appeal, they're throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at the appellate court. The thing is, Tony, what comes to mind is that the Court of Appeals, if there was a conviction in a criminal case at the trial court level, Court of Appeals would review that criminal case and have jurisdiction to make rulings on that criminal case. I'm not sure the Court of Appeals would have jurisdiction to make rulings on the probate case and how an error in the probate case may have disadvantaged a defendant in a criminal case. I'm not sure that I don't think that that's how court of appellate jurisdiction would work in that scenario. So the Court of Appeals might say, hey, it's unfortunate that Nick did not get the funds and that the probate court did what it did. But that appellate court does not have jurisdiction to say the error in the probate court gives you a new trial in the criminal court.
I'm just laughing because I'm watching Tony becoming a lawyer in the last couple of years. It's really good.
It's true. I mean, I'm always trying to think of these because it's like you want me to play Monopoly with you, but you're not going to give me all the money to play. That's not fair.
So I did look it up while we were talking. So L.A. uncontested probate administrations in L.A. still take 9 to 18 months if it's uncontested, and if it's contested, 12 to 24 months. So they would need that rush job, as Eric was stating, in order to do that. And now, it could actually play to, boy, I can't believe we're going such weeds on this one. It could play to Alan Jackson's benefit and Nick's benefit if they did release, like you were saying, Eric, partially, because I looked it up. Typically, Alan Jackson looks for about $250,000 for a retainer on a case like this, on typical cases. And so if they release that much and Alan Jackson thinks he has a shot at that guilty by reason of insanity plea, it could be just enough to push him over that edge.
Let me ask you this from an attorney standpoint, Eric. Obviously, you know, there's ways to be paid. There's the money that comes in that you'd certainly make, but there's also, you know, the clout, the publicity, the celebrity that comes along with some of this stuff, the notoriety, which then of course pays itself off by getting more clients, more high profile cases that you can make more off of. What is the threshold here for someone like Alan Jackson when you're weighing, okay, I mean, Nick only has so much money. And at the end of the day, to, you know, someone like Alan Jackson, it's a lot of money, but it's not like change the world money when you're Alan Jackson, in my opinion, of $1.5 million, especially for all the costs you're going to be incurring for your team to handle this damn thing. So it's not like it's a massive payday either way for Alan Jackson, even if he were to get his hands on the money. But the publicity, all of that, that's certainly worth quite a bit. Is it worth enough? Is it worth it for someone like Alan Jackson to step in, get whatever he gets out of Nick Reiner, if there's anything, for the publicity of being the attorney in another case that America can't stop watching?
My inclination is that it would be worth it. And you know, Tony, I heard an interview from Alec Murdoch's counsel, Dick Karpootlian, and at least one other gentleman, I forget. And I don't know how straight they were being with the reporter, but they essentially said, hey, we pretty much got paid on the first go-round, and we're on it on this second go-round. And then the omission suggested to me that they are not getting the same kind of compensation on the second go around. Yeah. Yet they are still in that fight. And I'm wondering if that principle is sort of transferable to Alan Jackson in this case, that, you know, he's really hot right now in terms of a celebrity mm-hmm. attorney, and to sort of approach that zenith and have another nationally publicized case that he could win, that could sort of propel him into an echelon where he doesn't have to market anymore. He doesn't have to spend money on marketing and getting cases for the next, you know, 30 years or whatever. They're just coming to him in droves. And mm-hmm. so I think it's probably worth it.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
But does he need Nick Reiner to do that? I mean, there's a gazillion cases he could take on that are high profile that I'm sure people would love to have him on, where he would pretty much have a guaranteed payday. Is it worth the weeds of Nick Reiner, I guess?
You know, what an awesome problem to have, where you can choose the biggest cases in the nation.
Yeah.
and select what you wish. You know, I don't think Nick Reiner's case is massive, but it's not, you know, the OJ case or something.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if Nick Reiner is the best case to choose for that purpose, but could be a darn good one.
Yeah. Does this go into the calculus of that too? Because, you know, so if Nick is found guilty, then he doesn't get the other half of the trust. That's, you know, that's pretty established, because he can't benefit from the death of because he killed his parents, basically, right? And so Alan Jackson would be limited then. We say limited, you know, people like you and me say, wow, limited to $750,000. But like you said, it's chump change to a guy like Alan Jackson, except for that notoriety. Is part of that calculus of him taking a case like this is the challenge of everyone knowing, even though he's innocent until proven guilty, that he was the one that stabbed his parents, that he got everyone thinking that he might get away with it? Is that actually part of that calculus?
I think that certainly could be an element. And one thing too, Robin, that you bring up is, in criminal cases, typically you can't have a contingency fee, meaning you can't have a situation where you get paid more if you win. That's unethical.
Right.
But in this scenario, if he wins, perhaps Nick gets that second payout, at which point does Alan Jackson get a second payout? And so is this motivation potentially raising an ethical issue whereby Alan Jackson has such a pecuniary interest in the outcome of this criminal case that it causes problems? I could foresee courts and prosecutors looking at that.
And I only said that, I didn't mean as him getting a second payout, is because when I looked up his general fee structure, on the possibility of the total fee being above 750, actually being in the million framework for the time and energy he puts in on a case like this, is actually within the realm of possibility. It's the only reason, because for billing purposes, he actually might be above that 750 that that Nick might get?
Something like, I mean, imagine a trial like this would cost, I mean, I have no idea, but we're probably millions and millions and millions of dollars. Like 1.5 is just kind of scratching the surface, right. Wouldn't it be?
You know, it's certainly going to be an extremely costly trial. You're talking about attorney's fees, not only for Alan Jackson, but he's going to have a legal team.
There's
going to be a lot of attorneys. Yeah. There's going to be paralegals. You're going to have to hire a number of experts. Those people are going to be costly, and it's going to drag on for a long period of time. There are filing fees. There are all sorts of expenses that are going to be associated. So, yeah, a high, high price tag on a case like
this. And the mental health fees alone to do all the testing that they're going to want to do on Nick, paying for those in LA County is not going to be cheap, as you said.
Right.
I mean, like, just the fees alone, I mean, $1.5 million sounds like a lot. It would go pretty quick, honestly. Yeah. Just if, you know, to try and put up the defense of Nick Reiner that would need to be put up in the defense of Nick Reiner if he's going to truly fight this in court. Or, you know, I mean, I guess maybe if you get to a plea, I don't know, maybe less expensive if it was a plea that came through this. I don't know. It would be very fascinating, though, as to where the twist and turn takes us next here in the Nick Reiner case. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of the coverage on that. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Let's go over to another case. Alec Murdaugh is getting a new trial, and now we know who's running the courtroom. Her name is Judge Deborah McCaslin. And the second she was announced, people started digging into her past. Who is she? What's the deal here? She's a judge with a reputation for being tough, fair, and impossible to rattle. But there's one thing that she said years ago under oath that is people asking whether Alec Murdaugh just caught the break of a lifetime. Attorney Eric Faddis is with us to help break all this down, and we're going to get into the story here of the new judge in the case. Eric, it broke the other day that Judge McCaslin is a new one on here. I was actually on an interview at the moment with Eric Bland talking about the case when that all came down. Got his reaction to it. What's your reaction to this judge, now that we've had a little bit of time to learn about her past?
I'll tell you, Tony, on every case, every civil case where we're going to file a lawsuit and every criminal case that I'm considering taking, one of the main questions is who's going to be the judge, or who could the judge be? Because those folks can have such an influence over the proceedings, over what happens in the case, you know. And then there are some civil cases where we say, oh, gosh, we've got this judge, so we've got to consider these arguments. We've got to consider these angles. We've got a different judge, so we've got to refrain from this type of advocacy and those things. And so really can make a tremendous difference. And I'll be interested to see how much of a contrast this new judge is with the last judge.
So one of the things I had read when I took a look at this one was that, yeah, she made those comments about the defense attorney those years ago. But she did so, like Tony said, under oath, and is actually part of her confirmation hearing. How common have you seen it that this actually pops up with judges having made positive statements about teachers, mentors, and guides in their past? And have you seen it impact negatively or positively? In other words, have you seen a bias from it from any other judge in your past?
Really, what I've seen, Robin, is this being having sort of a heightened magnification at the federal level, including during, like you said, statements made during the confirmation of federal judges, you know, by whom they were appointed, by which political party. And then you look at the case, if there are political potentially implications in the case, you know, like a case against a congressperson or a case involving political corruption, those kinds of things, oftentimes there will be motions to disqualify or motions to try to recuse a judge because, hey, this judge has expressed a bias in favor of Republicans and the defendants are Republican or something or, you know, just whatever. So that's kind of where I've seen it come up, including in this heightened political lawfare scenario we found ourselves in the past, you know, 4 to 8 years.
Do you see prosecution trying to maybe make that attempt on this one, saying that she should be recused from it because of those statements? Or is it so common that they'll probably just waive it and just move on?
prosecutors are less inclined to go down that road, in part because you're sort of questioning the judge's professionalism when you make such a request. And especially if the judge is like, no, I'm not going to recuse. Now they just might have a pretty bad taste in their mouth with respect to that prosecutor.
And you thought you're going to use not much of that financial stuff before. Why are you going to see it now?
I mean, you could get that. You really could. I mean, you could really poison the waters early on and put a bad taste into her mouth. I mean, people are people at the end of the day. She's not a robot. And she really has a good track record of being fair. I mean, so that that's great. I mean, looking at this, I'm looking at it. I don't have anything that I've looked at where I'm going, huge red flags. And, you know, and having talked the other day with Eric Bland, it was, you know, it was interesting to hear from someone who has some skin in the game here, who is invested in that ecosystem with the very players of this show, if you will. Even he was saying, good choice. She's a good judge. She's a good choice. But that being so, you know, just playing devil's advocate, you know, because I think it's important to do so. The advantage here is going to be to the Murdaugh team for this judge, because at the end of the day, if the verdict comes back not guilty, the state can't go retry it. The state can't go and say, the judge made a statement years ago about Dick Harpootlian and made an impression on her life. They were tight and they were friends, and it swayed that. The state can't do that. It doubled, the game's over. It's the rulings, but the defense certainly can. If it goes the other way, if this were different, if the dynamics were different, if there was some sort of sense of allegiance to one side or the other, the defense can always come back and appeal. So their advantage is on their side here. They don't really have an argument, though, either, of saying, well, it seemed like they were tight and they still found him guilty and the judge was harsh. But the dynamics are certainly on the side of the defense for this round. Would you not say that?
Oh, totally. And I remember being a prosecutor and kind of complaining about that double jeopardy constraint, in the sense that, you know, oh, this judge screwed up this trial and now it's not guilty and we can't do anything about it. Oh, woe is me. And now that I'm on the defense side, I sort of enjoy that potential advantage, just in the sense that if there is an error, there is a potential legal recourse for it. So, yeah, I think it's kind of all the benefit with not much of the risk on the defense side with respect to this issue.
But at the same time, though, do you see, so say it plays out like it did the first time and she's a tougher judge, she's rules, process, procedures, I mean, her reputation precedes her, as well as the fact that she did say good things about the defense. And if Murdaugh's found guilty again, does this then mean it's more challenging to have appeals by defense?
Necessarily, there are still appellate avenues, but yeah, it's sort of, I think, especially in the eyes of the public, bolster this notion that he was guilty, and he even had, you know, a ref who could be seen as being on his side, still guilty.
Play it out for us. Say a judge likes one of the lawyers in front of her, even a little. I mean, how does that actually show up in a courtroom? What would we see? Because people are people. Judges are humans. Attorneys are human. Have you ever witnessed that, where then it was brought up, you know, in an appellate issues or just in criticism of the case? So does this happen in the real world, Eric?
Oh, gosh, all the time. The time. There are, you know, there'll be events where, you know, the dinners where judges are going to prosecutors' homes and they're kibitzing and being social and everything. And same with defense attorneys and all of that. Yeah. And when it gets in that courtroom, you know, the judge has to make a call. So they're taking arguments from both sides. And sometimes they'll even make comments like, you know, I've known Mr. Prosecutor to be very fair and to be prompt about disclosing evidence to the defense. So on this alleged discovery violation, you know, I just don't see any merit in it. And anyone can sort of read through the lines being like, this judge just likes the person. And that like and that positive impression, that positive opinion of the person seems to be creeping into the ruling and happens all the time on both sides and on the bench.
Is there I mean, we see it in all industries, this sort of thing, too, where it's like certain people will cozy up to other people because at the end of the day, it will give them some sort of an advantage. And real, genuine relationships can form there. That and people can be professional and objective and do their jobs. But again, people can be people. Is there incentive sometime, or do you see sometimes prosecutors... And I'm not saying this is going on here by any means, but I'm just more so big picture question. Do you see sometimes prosecutors trying to get, you know, overly tight with the judge for the advantage, becoming buddies? Like, you know, they're fishing buddies, they're drinking buddies, they're vacation, all the shit. Just they're social friends. And then here comes trials. But, you know, we're professional. We can handle it. Does that exist in this ecosystem?
Oh, gosh. Absolutely.
My cousin Vinny.
On the criminal side, on the civil side.
Everywhere,
On the civil side, you know, you have a mediator sometimes who's trying to resolve the case. They're often a former judge.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people can have parties at conventions in a penthouse, and lo and behold, the mediator's there, and the attorney, the plaintiff's attorney's there too, and you know, they're having a great time, and then they've got a mediation a week and a half from that. You know, the same thing that happens on the criminal side too.
Yeah.
Is it intentional? Is it blatant? I guess that's up for debate, but
I mean, everybody, it's all part of the same ecosystem. So I can understand, you know, you're going to cross paths with people in that ecosystem. I guess my question on this with Alec is the ecosystem that small that there wasn't anybody that you could have picked that didn't have even the slight, you know, suggestion that there might be favoritism or connection or anything beyond professional behavior? And I'm not saying that it wouldn't be professional, but just the aura around it. Is there nobody else in the ecosystem that could have been chosen to be the judge for this case than her?
There are a ton of options, and the bench really has to be mindful of not having not of course engaging in propriety, but also avoiding the appearance of
that's
impropriety.
The thing. Why? If the is the pond that small? I mean, I don't think it is. Why even set it up this way for us even to be having this conversation? I guess.
Why exactly? Why take the risk? You know, I'm sure there is some new judge who's 40 years old or something who's competent to handle the case, and the chief judge in that locale could have appointed that person. But instead they appoint someone who's made favorable statements that appear to be a bias in favor of one of the attorneys, or at least someone could look at it that way. Why take the risk? I don't know, man.
So I'm going glass half full on this, maybe because they knew if he gets convicted again, there wouldn't be any, there'd be less pushback because of those statements. Maybe. And I'm also curious, Eric. So here you are, if you are the defense attorney for Alex, and what would you be doing different prep-wise from knowing you had Judge Newman first time and McCaslin this time from what we've seen and from her past and everything? What would be different, if anything?
I would have my team pulling all of her prior orders on issues that could be implicated in my trial. So how much of the financial crime stuff is going to come in round two? Appellate court said it was problematic in round one, but the judge still has a decision to make in round two. So you pull all these orders where the judge was deciding whether to let in other acts evidence under similar circumstances. And you say, hey, in this order, the judge gave weight to the fact that the financial crimes, the amount in controversy was really high. It was in the millions. That's something that matters to this judge. We're going to talk about that in our motion. We're going to talk about that during our oral argument because we think that's going to resonate with this judge because we have demonstrable evidence that it has before. That's just one example. And so you really research the heck out of that person and their prior rulings and try to craft and tailor your argument in a way that they're going to be receptive to.
So basically, they start triaging everything they have because you have limited bandwidth and with the resources you have. And so they start triaging what, based on the research of her, of what would resonate well and what wouldn't resonate well differently from the first case, correct?
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And some judges have issues that are really important to them and issues that they don't care about. And so you get a complete understanding of all of that, and then you lodge your advocacy in line with that understanding.
I know we don't know much because you haven't had a chance and no one has to really dig down into all those types of rulings. Can you see anything glaring right at the forefront that they might shift from the first trial to now or not yet?
Not quite yet. I think we got to sort of see how these proceedings are going to play out.
Yep.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always. Always fascinating to have you on and get
good
your
stuff.
Insight as we dive into the minutiae of all this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me. It's available wherever you get books. Go and check that out. Or audiobook. And that's going to wrap it up for today. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Let's talk about numbers, shall we? And it's not the one you think that's been, you know, floating around in this case for a little bit. The $1.5 million that he's suing to get. It's 300. Nick Reiner, accused of stabbing both of his parents to death in their Brentwood home, just filed a 136-page legal document in a Los Angeles probate court, 136 pages. And buried in the middle of all of it, right next to the demand for the $1.5 million payout, is a line asking for socks. Socks and hygiene products, because at Twin Towers, your commissary account is capped at $300. And according to this filing, somebody on the trust side promised to keep that amount funded. Per the petition, not a single dollar has ever showed up. So you've got an heir to one of Hollywood's biggest fortunes sitting in a cell asking a court for soap money and $1.5 million. That's where we start. And look, I spent 6 months telling you what I think about Nick Reiner. You know where I stand. Today, I'm doing something different. And honestly, I don't love it. I'm setting all of that down. All of it. And you know, as we do here, we do like to look at things from every perspective. There's not always a right or a wrong here. It's looking at things and trying to understand the motivation behind the actions that the people and the stories that we talk about have, how they got there. And express our own. That's what we do. So you know my opinion about Nick Reiner, my anger, my opinion, the gut reaction that I've been expressing. If you've been watching, if not, go back. There's a little bit to watch. We got to put it on a shelf here for the next few minutes because I'm going to answer one question as straight as I can. Should this man get the money? Get not the sock money. I mean, I don't think he even deserves that. Should he get the $1.5 million and the sock money, I guess? Two for one. My gut says absolutely not. Your gut probably does too. Every inch of your being probably says no, you do not get $1.5 million from the parents that you killed. But my gut and your gut don't write law in California. So I read the filing, every page, and what's in there is more complicated than anyone out there is making it. It is. It is very complicated. And it's an interpretation thing that a court's going to have to do its interpretation dance to figure out. Quick setup for anyone just finding this. If you're wanting to count what's going on here. Let's go back in time a little bit. December 25, Brentwood, California, Rob and Michelle Reiner stabbed to death in their home. Their son, Nick, who's 32, charged with two counts of first-degree murder, special circumstances, which means the death penalty is technically on the table. The DA hasn't confirmed either way. Nick pled not guilty, no bail. He had Alan Jackson, huge defense name, as his attorney initially. And then Jackson walked on January 7th because the money allegedly never came. At least that's the dots that many of us have came to connect. Allegedly. He didn't describe it as money. It was, what did he say? It was circumstances. It was something of that nature. He didn't directly say, hey, birdie, baby, I got your money. Don't you worry. Said, hey. No, that's not how it went. That wasn't how it went at all. He was an ODB. So Jackson walked. Then he gets a public defender. Then in June, his civil lawyers go into probate court with this petition, and it is aggressive. They want the distribution he says was due on his birthday in 2023. On his 30th birthday, plus the interest that money has earned since then. They want the commissary funded. They want a court to declare these distributions mandatory. They want damages from the trustee for breach. And the part, most of the coverage skipped right over, they want the second half too, the money he wasn't supposed to get until 35. All of it right now. Three questions. Why didn't he get it? Was it legal that he didn't? And should he get it now? We have to address this from a legal perspective, not necessarily our gut that tells us lock him away, close the door, turn off the oxygen to the bill. Oh, that's me. That's me. Like, can't do that. So the trust, let's go through. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through this. The links are in the description. So the trust, this thing is almost insultingly simple when you actually read it. It's called the Nick Reiner Children's Trust. His parents set it up in 1993, the year he was born, just his money, him as the sole beneficiary, and the instructions are, according to the petition, unambiguous. Half at 30, the rest at 35. Not if he's doing well, not if the trustee feels like it, or anybody else for that matter. The filing calls these payouts mandatory and unconditional. You can have trust like that. That's why it's not always a great idea to set up trust like that, because the person that you're setting it up for at 3 isn't exactly the same person at 30. And there's no way to really predict the future 27 years ahead of time. September 14th of 2023, Nick turned 30. And nothing happened. Nobody paid him. So, this time he was supposed to get the money. He was supposed to get $1.5 million at the age of 30. September 14th of 2023, he did not. His parents were alive and well at the time. If it's unconditional and whatnot, I don't know, you know. I'm going to guess, and your guess is probably as good as mine, that mom and dad or whoever had control of that trust looked at Nick and said, yeah, this is a horrible idea. Give him $1.5 million right now. He's going to go spend it on drugs. He'll be dead in a day. Now, looking back, retrospectively, they should have just gave him the money. He could have ended it himself. He would have. Almost guaranteed. You give the addict $1.5 million. It's like, go do whatever you like, right? Go have fun. Stop destroying our lives. They will. Oh, they will. And of course, if you love the person and care about them, you don't want their destruction. You don't want their, but now seeing how things turned out, I'm going to guess a few people might have said, we should have written that fucking check. Now, do the math on that with me, because this is what changes everything about how you should think about the story. September 23 to December 25, when his parents were found, is 27 months. If his lawyers are right, this was a mandatory distribution with no conditions, then that money stopped being trust property the day he turned 30. It became his, not his parents, not the trustees, his. The petition put it in exactly those words. The funds were wholly outside of any trust and beyond any trustee's supervision, which means this is not an inheritance fight. A birthday created this entitlement, not a death. I know it's an icky one to look at it. It makes you feel uncomfortable. And it's like, God damn it. If we're looking strictly at the letter of the law and the rules, again, I'm not a lawyer. I can't interpret it. But if the interpretation is correct, and look, there may be a caveat to it. I'm sure we'll hear it. Then it is what it is. And nobody, not the filing, not the reporting, nobody has explained why he didn't get paid in 2023. His parents were alive. They ran things. Whoever was managing that trust answered to Rob and Michelle Reiner directly. And for 27 months, the check just didn't go out. I mean, I keep coming back to that. We're going to sit with it at the end because it's one of the questions in this entire file that no court is ever seemingly going to be able to answer. It's more so, where does it go now, if it goes anywhere? Why did his parents build a trust in the first place? I mean, you probably already know Nick reportedly went through rehab more than a dozen times, starting when he was 14. According to reporting, he'd been prescribed medication for schizophrenia before the killings. You put money on a timer, half at 30, the rest at 35, and you love somebody, but you know a lump sum could destroy them? That's what the trust was, protection. And now it's the cage. Everyone is fighting over. So why doesn't he have it yet? Because since December, this trust has been a revolving door. An attorney named Paul Kanan took over in February. Nick's civil lawyers started pushing in April. Where's the age 30 money? And what they got back over April and May was what the petition calls a shifting series of excuses and justifications. First, Kanan's side says they're still trying to get into the accounts. They can't even confirm what's there. Then it's unresolved concerns about Nick's capability to make sound decisions. And the Slayer statute gets raised, the idea that he might be legally barred from the money because of what's occurred or he's accused of. Every time Nick's lawyers pushed, a new reason showed up. But here's what really got to me in this filing. The trustees didn't just say no, they set a condition. Kanan allegedly says Nick has to sit down with him or with the incoming trustee so they can personally evaluate whether he's capable of managing his own money. The incoming trustee wants Nick to meet with a criminal consultant she hired, and Nick's public defender looked at that setup and said, no way. Because none of those people are Nick's lawyers. Nothing said in that room is privileged. The filing is explicit about it. Any substantive discussion of his criminal case would be subject to compelled disclosure and will remain so even under a protective order. So think about what they're actually asking him to do. To get access to money, the trust says that it's already his, he'd have to sit in a room with people who can be subpoenaed and talk about a case where the state might try to execute him. That's the price of admission they set for apparently his own money. Are they running out the clock with lines and explanations and paths that they know will literally not lead to the money being protected, but lead to time being lost? Time that he doesn't have an attorney like Alan Jackson or someone of that ilk on his side. Now, I'm not going to manufacture a villain here because the mechanics don't need one. I mean, think about it from the trustee side for a second. You release the money, Nick gets convicted 2 years from now, and his siblings sue you for paying out a fortune to a man a jury just called a murderer. Or you hold it, Nick sues you for breach, which is exactly what's happening. You're getting sued either way. Stalling is the cheaper lawsuit. That's just math for everyone except the guy in the cell. And the irony is brutal. The petition says that the consultant, the incoming trustee, brought on being paid out of Nick's money is where that's coming from. Presumably at Nick's expense. So the incoming trustee that's been brought on is now taking a payday from the money that he was supposed to already have alone. I'm not trying to stand up for Nick here, but I am kind of going, this is why you don't set up trusts like this, where there's just irrevocable, you can't predict the future. You don't set up ridiculous amount of money trust for people that have not yet come into themselves. They set this up when he was like three. You don't know what's going to happen. And the track record, if you're in Hollywood, of celebrities' children turning out A-okay and making great decisions at 30, it's a small club. You're making a pretty big assumption that your kid's going to be in it. And I mean, they did right by the other two. They made it. Two out of three ain't bad, as Meatloaf used to say. The filing claims the trustee keeps depleting Nick's funds by hiring lawyers to argue for reasons to keep holding Nick's funds. So, I mean, it really, that could be an endless cycle right there. All right, you got your money. There's nothing left. Why? Because we've been using your funds to fight you with it. The fight over the money is being billed to the money. One thing I want to be clear about here, nothing in this filing, nothing shows Jake or Romy behind this hold. I'm not going to put that on them. What the file does show is what the delay costs. Alan Jackson has said publicly, he'll come back if the money lands, in his own words. That's not what his words were, but he said that in his own words. And the petition puts a number on the damage every single week this drags on, in the filing's words, prejudice to his defense that cannot be undone. All right, now the Slayer statute. This is the law everyone in the comments thinks ends the conversation. So let's actually look at it, shall we? But first, you need the map. Because there isn't one pot of money in this story. There are three. Pot one, the big Reiner family trust, the estate money. The trustee has already said nothing from those moves until the criminal case is done. And if Nick is convicted, California Slayer statute wipes him out. Done. Nobody's really fighting about pot one. Pot two and pot three are his individual trusts. The money his parents put aside specifically for him, split in half by birthday, the age 30 half and the age 35 half. That is what is at war. So Slayer statute, don't apply to that. Don't apply to the $1.5 million that he could get or more, because the 35 money they're asking for too, that could be coming. They're not going after the big pot. Slayer statute would apply to that. They are essentially arguing for money that he supposedly was owed prior to all of this happening and never received it. I look at this and go, is this the motive for murder? You have probate code 250. You feloniously and intentionally kill someone in California. You're treated like you died first. You get nothing from the will, not from a trust, nothing. It's the law, and it kept the Menendez brothers from ever seeing a dime of their parents' money. And yeah, most people hear that and think, done. Nick loses, move on. Except there's two things most people are missing, and they put it in a completely opposite, or they point in completely opposite directions. They pull you both ways. First one, this should scare you if you're Nick's lawyer. A criminal conviction triggers the statute automatically, sure, but a probate court doesn't have to sit around waiting for a jury. A civil judge can strip a beneficiary on what's called a preponderance of the evidence. More likely than not beyond a reasonable doubt. just more likely than not. Scott Peterson found that out the hard way. The civil side took his claim to Lacey's life insurance under that exact rule while his criminal appeal was still going. So when Nick's petition keeps leaning on presumed innocent, and it leans on it hard, understand that a probate judge doesn't owe that presumption anything. Second, one should scare you. This is another one. If you're the trustee, the Slayer statute takes away that you'd gain from someone's death. That's the whole design. But if the petition is right, if the age 30 money became Nick's property on September 14th of 23, 27 months before his parents died, then there's nothing there for the statute to grab onto. You can't lose to a rule about profiting from death when you had the money before anyone died. His lawyer's entire case runs through that argument. And to be honest, it's strong. I don't like saying that, but it's strong. Now flip to the other half. The age 35 money is still trust money right now. And by the trust's own terms, Nick is 32. Asking a judge to hand over that early is the weakest part of the petition. And the Slayer statute is sitting right on top of it. So it's an overreach, but if you're going to reach, you're going to go for as much as you can get. A compromise, if you will. We're not going to give you the 35 money, but we'll do the 30 money. Something like that. And then there's the capacity hole, the argument that he just can't handle his own money. The trust apparently has a mechanism for that too. A judge declares him incompetent or two licensed physicians put it in writing. According to the filing, neither one exists. No court order, no doctor's letters. A prescription for medication is not a legal finding that someone can't manage their finances. And I get it. Everybody's gut says, of course he can't be trusted with his money. But nobody, not the trustee, not you, not me, gets to skip the process because we're disgusted by what he's accused of. The trust has rules. They wrote them down. And right now, the most uncomfortable thing about this entire case is that the strongest thing in Nick Reiner's corner is a document his own parents created. So, Joni Paris Montgomery, if that name sounds familiar, it's because she was Britney Spears' conservator. She's a professional fiduciary, and she's the one taking over Nick's trust. And there's an email attached to the petition where her side describes the job as fighting it out to help Nick with, and I'm reading their words here, what limited trust funds he does have, knowing that some will need to be preserved to benefit him for the rest of his life. Preserved to benefit him for the rest of his life. Before a probate judge has even set a hearing date, the incoming trustee isn't planning a payout. She's planning preservation. She's budgeting for the length of a life she's already expecting him to spend locked up. So we have three questions, basically. Why didn't he get it before December, before any of this happened? Nobody has said. That silence is the loudest thing in the entire filing. After December, it's been fear, confusion, and a statute that might or might not apply. Was it legal before December? If mandatory and unconditional means anything, then withholding that money for 27 months with no explanation is really hard to defend. That's exactly why he's suing for interest and damages. And I think he's got a shot at winning that part. After December, it's genuinely unsettled. That's not me dodging. That's the actual state of the law right now. And anyone telling you this is a simple call really hasn't spent any time with this. Should he get it? Let's go pot by pot. The inheritance, his parents' estate? No. And if he's convicted, never. The age 35 money released early? Probably not. It's not his yet, and a judge has every reason to leave it where it is. The same reason his brother and sister who didn't kill their parents can't necessarily jump ahead on that one either. But the other one, the age 30 distribution, the heart of the million and a half everyone is screaming about, the law leans towards yes. And here's where I have to say the thing I really don't want to say. Probably should. If that's how this was laid out, you can't pick and choose your legal rules. There's a reasons for trust. There's a reasons these are set up the very specific ways they are. And they can't be, well, we changed our mind because he's doing this. And like, well, then you should have put more restrictions in there. And if the restrictions you put in there are not strong enough, or you can't produce what you need to produce to actually trigger the restriction, sorry. I mean, it sucks. It is. That's, again, if you got money, you got to think about this shit when you're setting up trusts and things of that nature. Because the presumption of innocence isn't something we hand out to people we feel sorry for. It's the line between every one of us and a government that has the power to take everything. If the state can pursue a man's life while a separate court holds his own money hostage, that line has a crack in it. And cracks like that don't stay one person's problem. But here's what no court is going to be touching. For 27 months, the two people who could have ended this with a phone call were alive. Rob and Michelle Reiner could have written that check. They could have told whoever was managing that trust to cut it loose. They didn't. The filing doesn't say why. And the only two people who ever knew the reason are gone. And the state of California says the reason they're gone is the man asking for their money. A judge is going to rule on their dollars. A probate fight will crawl along with its own slow clock because nothing in probate court moves fast. But no verdict, no ruling, no settlement is ever going to answer the question underneath all of this. His parents were why were his parents holding the money for 27 months? Nobody alive can tell us why exactly. But I think we could probably all connect the dots and figure out the reasons. In the end, nobody wins here. More money, more problems, right? What do you think? Should Nick get that money? Because, I mean, look at it. If he had gotten it where he was supposed to get it, and if their arguments are accurate, it's a big if. If you got one that can tell me, here's why this isn't, I'd love to hear it. Because I'm not saying I'm 100% right here. I'm saying, based on what I'm seeing right now, this is how it looks. I'm not an attorney. But had he gotten the money, he'd have, in theory, $1.5 million right now to spend on his legal defense. Now, had he gotten $1.5 million in 2023, do you for 1 second believe there'd be a penny left of it today? No. He probably would have died of an OD. And it would have been an afterthought. He would have been a story. Oh. Here's some story about the Reiners alive today. You hear something about, oh yeah, they did have that son. He died of that overdose a few years ago. That's sad. That's the story. That's what it would have been. Not all of this. Tragic in either way. But was either path completely avoidable? I don't know. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Be sure to press subscribe. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Looking for a little Hollywood style fun? Check out Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways exclusively at Chumba Casino. There's 10,000 ways to play. Get spinning for free at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane, Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.